Moin. Okay.
Okay, hello everyone. Sorry to be a bit late. I got hung up. So, welcome to the 52nd webinar on the Secret Doctrine, dedicated to our brother and mentor, Michael Robbins, who enthusiastically supported these webinar series. May his journey be filled with beauty and grace. This webinar series is available on vicara.us under the subheadings Moria Federation Webinars, then Webinar Series in Progress, as shown here. All episodes of this and the Secret Teaching Series are also now available on YouTube. Just do a search for Francis Donald and the webinar that you would like to see. Okay, this month in our reading of old diary leaves, Colonel Olcott and HPB have left India and traveled via a French steamer to Nice, France, where they are plunged into the occult society of the city. So if we could get a reader for this, please.
Sorry, hold on a minute here. I can't necessarily walk and chew bubblegum at the same time. Two evenings were given in part to mesmeric experiments by M. Robert, the Parisian professional, which were very instructive. And on another occasion, Mademoiselle Hemmerly and I attended a public lecture with experiments on the same subject by Professor Goody, the Italian specialist. The disbelievers in thought transference should be called upon to explain one of these experiments to which I was a party. The lecturer had two lady assistants, of whom one played the piano and the other was the mesmeric subject. He bade us notice the effect of the music on the latter, whom he had proved to us to be in a state of insensibility to pinches, pullings, and loud noises. He willed her to hear the music, and she responded in physical movements to every change in its character, expressing in highly dramatic postures the feeling appealed to for the moment.
Thank you, BL. And continuing.
Lynn, can you read that, please?
Pride, anger, mirthfulness, affection, disdain, defiance, terror were successfully portrayed by this cataleptical being as though she had some musical instrument played upon by the pianist's fingers. Signor Guidi then said that if any gentleman present wished to satisfy himself with the power of this subject to receive mental suggestions, he would be glad to give him a chance. I rose at once and offered myself for the experience. The lecturer came over to me, told me that I must concentrate my thought at the moment when I wish to fix the subject in the pose in which she might be at the time, and when he was satisfied that I understood him, grasped my hand for a moment and then stood aside. The pianist was then told to resume her playing, and the hypnotized subject began once more her statuesque poses. I took one good look at her, after which I leaned my chin on my cane and turned my eyes downward so that I could see her movements through my eyelashes, but she could not get any hint as to my purpose.
Okay, finally. A reader, please.
Martha, can you read that for us, please?
Yes. What happened? Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yes, yes.
Okay, I lost the picture. I'm sorry. Let me see. I should go to, I'm not sure what happened here.
Were you seeing it before, Martha?
I when I came on, I was seeing it. I left okay.
Probably the best thing to do is to go out and come back in.
I will do that. Thank you.
Okay, we'll have you read next the next thing.
Thank you.
Okay. Catherine, can you read that for us, please?
Yes. I let her go on until, in expressing the feeling of sublimity, she was leaning backward, seemingly past the center of gravity, and was kept from falling only by the contraction of the leg muscles. It was a posture so difficult that in the natural state, one could scarcely have retained it a minute. Then, without making the smallest gesture or muscular contraction to show my object, I mentally ordered her to become rigid. She responded instantaneously. The thought had barely been formed in my mind before she caught and obeyed it. With her head thrown far back, her torso bent back from the hips at an oblique angle, her arms held in their full length pointing upward, her knees bent forward, she seemed as if immovable, as if she were a statue of bronze. It was to me a most instructive experiment, the more so in that the mere clasping of my hand for a moment by the mesmerizer sufficed to put me in a psychical rapport with the subject without the speaking of a word by him or by me.
Thank you. Okay. So I'd like to do a quick review on the layout, because there's been some confusion on this. The text to be read is always in the middle section of the page. The highlighted area in the right panel shows where that text is in the secret doctrine, in the book itself. The highlighted part on the left panel, usually divided into an A and B section, indicates the part of the verse that is being referred to in the text. Okay, just so you understand. Also, I have a question for BL. I'm using a little different arrangement here with the Zoom. Is the resolution pretty much the same as normal?
Yes, I believe so.
Yeah, it looks pretty much like it does all the every time, huh?
Yes.
Okay, real good, good. Okay, HPB's commentary on stanza 5, verse 6, which we're near the beginning of, has so far reviewed a number of fundamental concepts from earlier stanzas, including the nature of and differences between the first, second, and third logi. Before we pick up where we left off last time, let's define a few of the Sanskrit terms that appear in this paragraph. The Theosophical Glossary defines Sukshma Sharira as the, quote, subtle body, popularly astral body, often confused with the Linga Sharira. The footnote defines it as dreamlike, elusive body with which are clothed the inferior dhyanis of the celestial hierarchy. But the term appears nowhere else in HPB's writings and is not one of the seven human aspects usually listed. But I think it's close to, or could be confused with, this Linga Sharira, you know, the model body. Okay. Next, the Sushumna is the central kundalini channel. I know most of you probably know this, in the spine, which is one of the many meanings of the caduceus. Next, let's take a look at the Theosophical Glossary entry on the Brahmaranda. We get a reader for this, please.
Okay, Martha, can you read that for us, please?
Yes, I can. Brahmarandra, Sanskrit. Brahmarandra from Brahman, cosmic spirit, and Randra, opening, fissure, cavity, Brahman's crevice. A mystical suture or opening in the crown of the head through which a person leaves his body at death, connected with the heart by means of the Sushumna Nadi, a psycho-vital channel in the spinal column.
Okay, and finally, let's reread the definition of Paramapada. Can we get a reader for this?
Yes, Anne, can you read that for us, please? Oops, I lost Anne. Okay, Dana, can you read that for us, please? Oops, I guess you guys aren't hearing me. Kirsten?
We can hear you.
Yeah,
we can hear you.
Okay, great, thank you.
Is it me, Kirsten?
Yes, please.
Yes, Paramapada, Sanskrit, Paramapada, high state or position, that which is not material, but loftily spiritual, in and to which pertain Jiva Muktas are monads who have attained freedom from karma. Thus, they attain the highest condition or state in any hierarchical sense.
Thank you. So with these definitions in mind, let's take a look at this passage, including the footnote, please. Could we get a reader?
Scott, can you read that for us, please?
The jiva, soul, goes with shukshuma sharira from the heart of the body to the brahmarandra in the crown of the head, traversing shushumna, a nerve connecting the heart with the brahmarandra. The jiva breaks through the brahmarandra and goes to the region of the sun, the surya mandala, through the solar rays. Then it goes through a dark spot in the sun to Paramapada. The jiva is directed on its way by the supreme wisdom acquired by yoga. Both footnotes?
We just read the Sukshma Sarir, so I think just the second one would be good.
That sounds good. Compare this esoteric tenet with the Gnostic doctrine found in the Pista Sophia, knowledge equals wisdom, in which treatise Sophia Akhmat is shown lost in the waters of chaos, matter, on her way to supreme light, and Christos delivering and helping her on the right path. Note well, Christos with the Gnostics meant the impersonal principle, the Atman of the universe, and the Atma within every man's soul, not Jesus. Though in the old Coptic manuscripts in the British Museum, Christos was almost constantly replaced by Jesus.
Okay, any thoughts or questions? Though it uses a lot of Sanskrit terms, this passage is basically an occult description of the journey of the jiva, or imprisoned soul, from personality orientation all the way up to solar consciousness. Let's take a closer look at the process here called traversing Sushumna. Can we get a reader, please?
Jan, can you read that for us, please?
Sanskrit, probably from excellent, excelling, and sumna, musical hymn, happiness, joy, perfect harmony, one of the three channels forming the spiritual column of the body. These three channels are the main avenues not only for the psycho-vital economy of the body, but for the spiritual and intellectual currents between the head and the body. In all cultism, the spiritual column plays many psychological or physiological roles, but is especially threefold in its functions. The central channel, or nadi, the sushumna nadi, is the special carrier of the solar ray, which comprises not merely physiological forces and attributes, but the spiritual and intellectual qualities and powers. The two other channels are the Ida and Pinga Gala. The Suhumna connects the heart with the Rama Rudra and plays an important part in yoga practices.
Thank you. So of special interest here, is the, hang on just a second, sorry, I have a technical problem here. Okay. Okay. So of special interest here is the fact that the Sushumna carries the solar rays, which also animate the Surya Mandala, thus connecting the micro to the macrocosm. Perhaps the most unexpected teaching here is that the jiva goes through a dark spot in the sun, a reference which baffled both Archibald Keightley and, surprisingly, HPB herself. Could we get a reader for this dialogue, Secret Doctrine Dialogues?
Francis, could I ask a question, please?
Of course, always. Any of you can always ask questions.
I'm kind of wondering about what the jiva actually is. It's a solar ray, it's our consciousness. There's an actual seed? Or how would you describe what it is?
They call it a seed. It's been described as the spark or flame that is the pilgrim who makes the great journey in consciousness, right? So it is one, you know, for us, it is one with the monad, but for the time being entrapped in personality consciousness. As it progresses, it moves up through the stages. Once you're soul infused, then the jiva is expressive of soul awareness, right? Once you're consciously one with the monad, the jiva is expressive of monadic consciousness. So you could say it's that inner spark that is the pilgrim on the way.
Okay, great. Thank you.
You bet.
Okay, Yvonne, can you read that for us, please?
Sure. Mr. A. Knightley, can you explain the esoteric meaning of the sentence? Then it goes through a dark spot in the sun. Madam Blavatsky, you had better ask the Dantons because I don't understand what it means. The dark spot in the sun must be on par with the angel standing on the sun. I could never understand what was meant. I even took the trouble of writing to the pundit himself, and I commissioned Hart to ask him what it meant, and he could not tell me. So what can I do? Mr. B. Knightley, then you cannot blame us for asking the question. Madam Blavatsky, I cannot. I don't know myself what it means. I don't know any better, but I do think, you know, that it means the heart of the sun from the Secret Doctrine.
Thank you. Secret Doctrine Dialogues. Okay. Though I used photos of sunspots to illustrate this passage, the phrase dark spot in the sun probably doesn't refer to literal sunspots, as HPB seems to suggest in two of her comments. First, the dark spot in the sun must be on par with the angel standing on the sun. And second, I do think, you know, that it means the heart of the sun. So if nothing else, this dialogue between HPB and Keightley underscores the fact that while writing the Secret Doctrine, HPB's intellect was not the source of the material. Rather, she was, like A.A.B., a skilled amanuensis for the masters that worked through her. Of course, you know, both H.P.B. and A.A.B.'s intellect helped in that transference, but it wasn't in either case the source of the material. Any thoughts or questions about this? This Secret Doctrine Dialogues often gives us really interesting insights into H.P.B.'s character. Okay.
Hi, can I say something?
Of course.
I think it's interesting that she, this dialogue, she proclaims she doesn't know what it is, but at the very end, she knows what it is. And I find that just interesting. It's almost like she didn't want to have to explain all of it because it would open up a can of worms. But because the heart of the sun being a darkness compared to the light of the physical sun, I think is I'm very suggestive of what she said.
Yeah, and you know, you almost get the sense that as she's answering, her intuition, you know, kind of becomes activated. Mm-hmm. And she finally, comes to some explanation. You know, I find that's often the case in the dialogues. In fact, sometimes she blusters for a while saying, why do you think I should know this? I know mathematician or whatever. But then usually by the end of the exchange, something comes forth, you know.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, it's interesting. So, you know, you could say that the dark spot in the sun is a kind of negative space, you know, which is abstract in its sense. And, you know, so it could be a passage, not literally, I don't believe, but, you know, symbolically a passage through to the heart of the sun, which would be that next level of solar reality, right? Okay. Let's see here.
We've got another hand, Scott. You want to go ahead?
Yeah, I was thinking about this dark spot. It seems like one thing it could be is just a total blind. It reminds me right off of a black hole. But this could be just a total blind. It's just black in the center. And she's not made aware of what it's covering, but she's guessing at it. I think DK could have answered the question with her, through her, but did not.
Yeah, there was a lot more blinds in Secret Doctrine times compared to later, but I agree. I think it is a blind, because, you know, first of all, blinds are often, you can tell them from the fact that they'll use a physical counterpart to some subjective reality. And so, you know, her final answer here, you know, I do think, you know, that it means the heart of the sun suggests a real possibility for what a sunspot would be a blind for, you know. Of course, we can't know for sure, but.
But you're saying it's not a spot on the sun, it's in the sun.
Yes.
So it's not going to be visible, even as I wouldn't think as a sunspot.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Mystery anyway.
Yeah, I really don't think it's, you know, what modern science calls sunspots, which they've measured their temperatures, you know, they have theories about what they are. No, that's not, it's a dark spot, as you say, in the sun. Okay.
Lynn suggests the Gayatri.
Oh, yes. Right. The face of the true spiritual sun, right? Yeah, indeed. Okay, let's take a look at the second footnote, which references Sophia's journey, Pisti Sophia, through the waters of chaos. Sophia's pilgrimage is a more esoteric version of the hero's journey than is usually found in the Greek mysteries that were written around the same time, or that were practiced, I should say, around the same time. Since, at least according to C.W. King, Gnosticism was based on the Egyptian system rather than the Greek system, which is a real distinction. Anyway, the pisti sophia first came to light when a Mr. Askew bought the ancient manuscript at a London bookstore for £10 in 1735, then sold it to the British Museum. It is considered to be the most important of all the surviving Gnostic doctrines, most of which were unknown until the 1945 discovery near Nag Hammadi, Egypt, of 13 leather-bound codices. In his Gnostics and Their Remains, C.W. King gives us a clear description of the Pistis Sophia, in which, quote, Sophia Akamoth is shown lost in the waters of chaos on her way to supreme light, and in which Christos delivers her onto the right path. You know, those of you, and I think it's most of you, who are also doing the secret teachings, you know, we took a look at Gnosticism a while back, and this was, we also looked at the Pisti Sophia and more deeply than we will today, but won't hurt to review this general description of the Pistis. Could we get a reader, please?
Robert, can you read that for us, please?
Pistis Sophia professes to be a record of the higher teaching of the Savior communicated to his disciples during the 11 years he passed with them on earth after his crucifixion and when he had returned from his ascension into heaven. This ascension had been made from the Mount of Olives, where he received from on high two shining vestures inscribed with five mystic words and the names of all the powers whose domains he had to traverse. He thus passes through the gate of the firmament, the sphere of fate, and the regions of the 12 great eons, all of whom in succession are terror-smitten and fall down before him and sing hymns of praise. On arriving at the 13th eon, he finds seated below and weeping the excluded power, Pistis Sophia. She, having once caught a glimpse of the supreme light, is seized with a desire to fly upwards into it, but Adamus, the ruler of her proper place, being enraged at this act of rebellion against himself, caused a false light, a veritable ignis fatuus, to shine upon the waters of the subjacent underlying chaos, which lured down the hapless aspirant, and she was inextricably immersed in the abyss and beset by the spirits thereof, all eager to deprive her of her native light. The doctrine of the admixture of light derived from the treasure of light with matter, its imprisonment therein, and its extraction and recovery by the appointed receivers of the light is the pervading idea of this revelation. As part of the same notion comes the frequent allusion to the Greek word, or chaotic commixture of light and matter, to reorganize which is the special object of the Savior's descent from above.
Do we have one of our Greek students with us today?
We do.
Maybe she could describe that word. He calls it the chaotic commixture of light and matter. Does that seem accurate to you? It's all right. You know, maybe a really obscure Greek word. It's not like just because you're Greek, you know every word of the Greek, you know, language, just like, you know, but I just thought you might have some insight onto this. If not, that's perfectly fine. It's okay. Don't worry about it.
Who wrote this that we're just reading? Is that from Mead writing or King?
It is from The Gnostic and the Remains, which is C.W. Okay. King. Here's the next part of it. So let's keep going. Can we get a reader for this?
Hold on. Yvonne's got her hand up. Go ahead, Yvonne.
Where is that part where he came back after he ascended and spent 11 years with the disciples? I hadn't heard that.
Right. Yeah.
The previous slide?
Right here. Yeah. Yeah. This is the Gnostic version, right? And which is not recorded at all in the New Testament in this way. You know, what was it he spent? I don't remember how long. He did spend some amount of time with him when he came back, and you know, that was when Thomas thrust his hand in to believe that it was really the Christ. But here, you know, it shows a very, very different version, right? 11 years after his crucifixion. So
after he had ascended, then he came back 11 years and ascended again.
That's right. It was literally a second ascension. And this is described, and actually the power went out in my house. And so I took the opportunity to go read about half of the Pistis Sophia. And it was great because it showed the two ascensions of Christ. And on the first, it describes these robes of light that had these sacred words inscribed on them. And then on the second ascension, it was an even more extraordinary level of light and additional words. It's incredibly esoteric material. I recommend it.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, and then Yvonne, can you read that next page?
Okay, here we go.
There you go. Thank you.
Sure. At least one half of the book is taken up with the account of the successive steps by which she ascends through all the 12 aeons by the Savior's aid, and the confession she sings at each stage of her deliverance out of chaos. Each confession is proposed by Jesus to a disciple for explanation and is referred to some psalm or other prophecy containing parallel sentiments, this concordance being occasionally made out with considerable ingenuity. A remarkable peculiarity is that all throughout, Mary Magdalene is the chief speaker and the most highly commended for her spiritual knowledge, though once she is sharply rebuked by Peter for her presumption in thus perpetually putting herself forward unbidden and not giving the men a chance to speak. After Pistis Sophia has thus regained her lost position, the most valuable portion of the exposition of doctrines commences. The Magdalene asks the great question as to the final cause of sin, to which Jesus returns a long and minute description of the composition of the soul of man, which is fourfold: the divine spark therein, a particle of the light, yet entangled in that word, being encased in a threefold envelope formed out of the effluvia of the rebellious aeons, the tendency of which is to keep it in subjection to the passions and to themselves, so that when separated from the body, it may not be able to escape out of their domains, the regions of the mid-space, here represented as places of pain from the Gnostics and their remains.
Thank you. So let's see if that word is the same as the previous word. Looks like it is, yeah. So that's this commixture of light and matter, right? Which of course, all levels of, you know, in theosophical speaking, it would be all the subplanes of the cosmic physical plane are commixtures of a chaotic commixture of light and matter, right?
Francis?
Yeah.
Sorry. Efrosini says, Kerasmos, it must have something to do with the Kikion, an ancient Greek drink, an ancient mixture in the mysteries of antiquity.
Oh, wow. Thank you.
And I'm sorry, Efrosini, if I butchered any or all of those words.
and I'm sorry if was it Efrosini that I put on the spot. I don't mean to do that, but that's very useful information. It's quite interesting. It kind of ritualizes, you know, this idea a bit. Okay, anyway, I was really struck by what a central role light plays in the entire P.C. Sophia narrative, right? And we know from theosophy that light is soul awareness, is the realm of light. And it really is couched in those terms, much more in the usual materialistic terms, right? Okay, so yeah, this is a painting of P.C. Sophia by Joffre Bouchard. Okay, next up, could we get a reader, please?
Lynn, can you read that, please?
Yes, and I put into the chat box, does it have a relationship to soma, which was what? A drink? That word, that Greek word.
It could. Soma, which is all called the elixir of life, is, you know, I'd say closer to what Efrosini was saying. She said something about a chalice or a libation chalice.
Well, she said kikion, which I'm not sure what that is, but she said an ancient Greek drink, an ancient mixture in the mysteries of antiquity.
Yes, well, in that case, certainly, it would have a lot to do with soma, which is, you know, it's called, it was really big among the alchemists, but in Hindu tradition, it was the sacred drink that allowed one to move into the god realm. Now, you know, this could also be a metaphor for a stage of consciousness, but it was described as an actual drink, right? And even the plants involved, you know, in creating this drink. So yeah, interesting that it has a Greek equivalent. It's not something I was aware of. Okay, can we get a reader?
The jiva thus proceeds to Pramapada at the aid of Athivakikas, bears in transit, from known by the names of Arkihas, Aditya, Pajrapati, etc. The Arkis are here mentioned are certain pure souls, etc. Vishitadatawata Catechism by Pundit Mashachara. No spirit except the recorders, Lipika, has ever crossed its forbidden line, nor will any do so until the day of the next pralaya, for it is the boundary that separates the finite, however infinite in man's sight, from the truly infinite. The spirits referred to, therefore, as those who ascend and descend, are the hosts of what we loosely call celestial beings, but they are, in fact, nothing of the kind.
Okay, Eddie. Thoughts arrive from this. Again, we have a bunch of Sanskrit terms, right? Paramapada, as we just discovered, means the highest state or position, which is only achieved by those who have attained freedom from karma. Ativahika are a particular group of devas who help the disembodied soul after death in its transit to Paramapada. As to the Arkihas, this is the only instance of the term in all HPB's writings, as well as in my collection of other esoteric books. Aha does often occur as a suffix in translation of ancient Egyptian, such as Hor Aha, and Aha was the name of a pharaoh in the first Egyptian dynasty. Aha may be an honorific, like Shri in Hindu. Thus, Arkihas may mean something like the highest of the holy ones, but this is only a guess. So, The jiva thus proceeds to Paramapada by the age of Ativahikas, known by the name of Arkiahas, might be translated to something like the soul proceeds to the highest state of consciousness by means of a group of devas called Arkiahas, whose special task is to help the disembodied soul to make this transition. But then we're told no spirit but the Lipika ever crossed its forbidden line, nor will any do so until the day of the next pralaya. For it is the boundary that separates the finite, however infinite in man's sight, from the truly infinite, suggesting that either Paramapadha is a potential stage, which is only realized at the end of the Manvantara, or that Paramapada is the highest state that can be achieved until the day be with us at the time of our systemic pralaya. Any thoughts about this? It gets confusing when she uses so many Sanskrit terms, but you know, once you wade through it, you find that often what she's actually saying isn't that complex. Finally, we have the spirits referred to, therefore, as those who ascend and descend are the host of what we loosely call celestial beings. But they are, in fact, nothing of the kind. Okay, I see a hand.
Yes, please go ahead, Scott.
I didn't mean to interrupt you. The note I have on Paramapada from the time we read this was that it's called a supreme step. It means that it's the abode of Vishnu. Don't know the sources of that, but that's what I have in my notes.
Okay, yeah. So the abode of Vishnu as the sustaining God, right, would be that place, very much like the second aspect at the God in the God realm, right? You have Shiva, first aspect, right, in Brahma, the creator, as the third aspect. So it would be that sustaining influence. And therefore, it would be the very highest stage that could be achieved before all was brought back into Godhead, you know, the Shiva aspect, called the day be with us. Thanks for that. That's actually useful.
Separating the sixth from the seventh plane, as we know it.
Yeah, yeah, right. You know, the second through seventh from the first would be another way of saying that, right? Separating them. Yeah.
Lynn says the monadic plane ruler.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, but that's this is what we're talking about here is beyond monad. Actually, even beyond the first subplane as a separate. When you have a first subplane, the other six are inferred. So this is a stage where all the seven are one, right? Remember the third logos, from the third logos, you have the seven differentiations in as the seven rays or the seven sephiroth, as they're called, you know, the great hosts that create all differentiation. But at this stage, it all goes back into the absolute, and there is no Godhead because all is God immanent. Okay, so finally we have the spirits referred to, therefore, as those who ascend and descend are the hosts of what we call loosely celestial beings, but they are in fact nothing of the kind, and we find out why they are, quote, nothing of the kind in this next paragraph, because she describes who they are. Can we get a reader, please?
They are entities of the higher worlds and the hierarchy of being, so immeasurably high that to us they must appear as gods and collectively God. But so we, mortal men, must appear to the ant, which reasons on the scale of its special capacities. The ant may also, for all we know, see the avenging finger of a personal god in the hand of the urchin, who, in one moment, under the impulse of mischief, destroys its anthill, the labor of many weeks, long years in the chronology of insects. The ant, feeling it acutely, and attributing the undeserved calamity to a combination of providence and sin, may also, like man, see in it the result of the sin of its first parent. Who knows, and who can affirm or deny? The refusal to admit in the whole solar system of any other reasonable and intellectual beings on the human plane than ourselves is the greatest conceit of our age. All that science has a right to affirm is that there are no invisible intelligences living under the same conditions as we do.
Thanks, BL. So I think BL's HPB is having a little fun here. So first up, they are entities of the higher worlds and the hierarchy of being, so immeasurably high that to us they must appear as gods, and collectively God. And she's talking here about those who ascend and descend, right? And, you know, from one point of view, everything descends and ascends, but those who have the freedom to ascend and descend would be these beings who are so immeasurably high that they would appear as God to us, right? DK confirms their high station when he says their united aura or area of influence and the extent of their magnetic and dynamic radiation corresponds roughly to the aura of the planet itself. They contain within their ranks members who are identified with the Lords of the Seven Rays. So next, HPB gives us an entertaining analogy, suggesting that the difference in consciousness between a Lapika Lord and a human being is something like that which exists between a human being and an ant, with the added illustration of the calamitous effect of our interference in their little lives. I especially enjoyed the dig at Christianity when HB references the sins of the ant's first parent, right? Any thoughts about this?
That last sentence is really interesting, that all that science has a right to affirm is that there are no invisible intelligences living under the same conditions as we do. Does that mean because the conditions we live in are not invisible? I mean, what is exactly... I mean, I love what she wrote here, but I want to just clarify that last bit.
Yeah. Here, let's see what I said about that. I'm jumping forward a bit. Yeah, I think the same conditions as we do are the three worlds of human endeavor, you know, the astral, physical, and mental, and that those that know invisible intelligences are subject to these conditions. I think that's what she means. And that's all that science has a right to affirm. In other words, from a scientific point of view, there are no invisible intelligences because basically they're not here. They're not in this place where science and the scientific method is functioning.
Although the three worlds are filled with beings who would be invisible in terms of scientific perception.
Well, that's right. Yeah, you know, astral beings, etc. Right, but yeah. they're not within the realm of science, and that the scientific measurement does not, adduce their existence. So they lie outside of the system wherein science can measure their existence. I think that's all she's saying here. Uh-huh. All that science has the right to affirm, you know, it's, again, I think she's still a bit tongue in cheek here, is that, you know, science has the tendency in its conceit to say there's nothing beyond the measurable, right? Or at its best, it says there's nothing beyond the measurable that science can either say exists or doesn't exist, you know. But then there are materialist scientists who take that into a belief, you know, an atheistic belief system, right?
Yeah, it's a tricky thing, because under the same conditions as we do, also could mean the illusion that they live in, we live in. And it's almost like, you're right, I think this, obviously she's really poking the bear with all this stuff, but this one has a sort of special quality.
Yeah. Yeah, I think in some ways it's, you know, the enlightened science would be agnostic. You know, while, let's see, how can I say this? You know, within the scientific system, the enlightened scientist would profess an agnostic viewpoint through science. And the prejudiced scientist, the materialist scientist, of which there are many, would be an atheist, you know, would wrongly conclude that because science can't measure the unseen presences or invisible intelligences, that they don't exist, right? Whereas the more enlightened scientists would just recognize that within the functionality of science, they cannot be deduced or measured, right? And then, of course, there are scientists who very much through their own experience, like Einstein, believe in deity, right?
And not to beat a dead horse, but another way to look at this is that when she says all that science has a right to affirm is that there are no invisible intelligence living under the same conditions as we do. In other words, there are gazillions of invisible intelligences, but they don't live in the same ignorance that we live.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, let's see here.
Okay, Efrosini says, and this is in reference to the verse over there. The pro-Socratic philosopher Heraclitus said, "Sun will not overstep his measures. Otherwise, the Arrhenians, ministers of justice, will find him out." What does Blavatsky mean here, that even the gods cannot cross the ring pass not that Lipika pose?
Because gods are an individualized source, even at their highest level. They are the first stage of differentiation, right? So even the one God who is, you know, in Blavatsky speak, is Oia Ohu, as the third logos, even at that highest level, it's the sum total as a unity, which is called, I think it was in our last time together, we talked about the difference between the two ones. There's the one, you could say in all capitals, which is not an individual, it's not a singularity at all. It is Godhead, the absolute. That's where the ring is, between that first one, which is completely, in terms of numbers, it is no number. It is that which precedes any definition, including unity. And then the second one is the highest God as a singularity. And the ring pass not passes between them, the Lipika ring pass not. As long as there's any diversity, any identity even as the sum total of unity, you're beyond, you're outside that ring past not. Does that make any sense? I hope so. It's very abstract stuff.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. And then Roger says the right to affirm doesn't qualify the affirmation is right.
That's a mind twister. Right.
I like it.
That's a correct statement.
Yeah.
Right. You know, it's in a way, it's two uses of the word right, you know. So that's where it's tricky. Anyone else? Okay. So the refusal next, the refusal to admit in the whole solar system if any other reasonable intellectual beings on the human plane than ourselves is the greatest conceit of our age. This is in part, as you know, I've been saying, due to the scientific method, which recognizes only that which can be measured by instruments of science, and as HBV points out, an unconscious conceit based on the scientific method that humankind is at the top of the evolutionary chain. Because there's nothing measurable beyond the human being. That's, you know, why it's a conceit. Okay, next up. Can we get a reader, please? Thanks for all your questions. It's always more interesting, you know, when we talk about this stuff.
Scott, can you read that for us, please?
You cannot deny point blank the possibility of there being worlds within worlds under totally different conditions to those that constitute the nature of our world. Nor can it deny that there may be a certain limited communication between some of those worlds and our own. The greatest philosopher of European birth, Immanuel Kant, assures us that such a communication is in no way improbable. I confess I am much disposed to assert the existence of immaterial natures in the world and to place my own soul in the class of these beings. It will hereafter, I know not where or when, yet be proved that the human soul stands even in this life in indissoluble connection with all immaterial natures in the spirit world, that it reciprocally acts upon these and receives impressions from them.
Mm-hmm. You don't have to read the quote there, unless you've been brushing up on your German. Any thoughts or questions about this? The fact that science can't deny the existence of the unseen world is a testament to a methodology that also limits its scope. You know, we were talking about this before. It's really, in some ways, the answer to Robert's question, making its dogmas more subtle than that of many religions. This has left the door ajar for a new wave of physicists, including those following in the footsteps of David Bohm, who are developing his theory of a causal implicate order, right? HPB recognized Kant's genius and often discussed his ideas in her works. Let's take a look at a quote from near the end of The Secret Doctrine, which expands on Kant's ideas concerning immaterial nature, specifically his theory on a universally pervading primordial substance. Could we get a reader, please?
Catherine, can you read that for us, please?
Here, we have the world system reborn from its ashes through a nebula, the emanation from the bodies dead and dissolved in space, resultant of the incandescence of the solar system, reanimated by the combustible matter of the planets. In this theory, generated and developed in the brain of a young man hardly 25 years of age, who had never left his native place, a small town of northern Prussia, Königsberg, one can hardly fail to recognize either an inspiring external power or the reincarnation which the occultists see in it. It fills a gap which Newton, with all his genius, failed to bridge. And surely it is our primeval matter, Akasha, that Kant had in view when proposing to solve Newton's difficulty and his failure to explain by the natural forces the primitive impulse imparted to the planets by the postulation of a universally pervading primordial substance. For, as he remarks in chapter 8, if the perfect harmony of the stars and planets and Lee's hypothesis cosmogonique is admitted, the coincidence of their orbital planes prove the existence of a natural cause, which would thus be the primal cause, which cannot really be the matter which today fills the heavenly spaces. Rather, it must be that which filled space was space originally, whose motion in differentiated matter was the origin of the actual movements of their sidereal bodies, and which, in condensing itself into those very bodies, thus abandoned the space that is found void today.
Okay, thoughts or questions about this? Not easy,
particularly
easy material. It's sufficient to realize that there were important philosophic thinkers in the European tradition that intuitively mirrored the ancient wisdom teachings as found in Egyptian, Chaldean, among the Dantons, you know, and in a sense rethought it or were re-inspired to these truths and wrote them in their own language according to their own thoughts. This particular one is about this the concept of the Akashic, you know, which is that all substance is an emanation from the Akashic realm, right? So any further observations about this?
The only way I can see that in my limited view is thinking about it as the cloud, where it would just be able to hold all the information and store it.
Mm-hmm. And if you just take that idea, and you know, if you're going to apply it to what he says here, that this primordial substance is the source of the outer substance that then forms the sun and planets. We actually looked at this some time ago. There's a whole old commentary that describes this, but that you have a precipitation of the Akashic into materiality, but that the matrix is pre-exist the substance itself. And he made an effort at the ripe old age of 25 to form this into, you know, an understandable theory. And then go ahead. You were about to say something?
I was agreeing with you.
Always worth a pause. So then you have here something similar, right? Which is that the existence of the immaterial natures in the world forms an indissoluble connection with all that exists. It's a similar kind of thing. Here it's focused on soul as being that source. And then in this excerpt, He's talking about that primordial substance that forms all of the solar system. Okay.
So. Yvonne has her hand up. Go ahead, Yvonne.
A couple things. This last sentence there, in condensing itself in those very bodies, thus abandoned the space that has found the void today. I was wondering if that abandoned the space, if it goes into a black hole in Pralaya, that's why it's saying there's nothing, there's void there. It just goes into a black hole in Pralaya. Also, this thing about the Akasha, the different levels of that, I'm sort of comparing that to like the white magic that I'm studying. So it manifests on the mental plane first, and soul plane, and then into the astral, and then it manifests on the physical etheric plane last. And when we see it, but before that, it has been manifested on a higher plane. Is that similar? Same idea?
I think it's very much, it's really not, it's the same thing, the same idea altogether. Right. That, you know, the seven subplanes of our cosmic physical plane are all interrelated bodies of one thing, which has its essence at, on the highest level and its most physical and apparently disconnected on the lowest level. Right. And all the intermediate stages show aspects of the of this one of the true identity of whether it's a substance or a being, right? It's interesting in the PC Sophia, all of these seven subplanes have governors, right? And the governors give these attributes as the primordial passes into their domain, right? And that they're given these gifts, and there's seven governors, right? Yeah, the same thing. And you know, all the mythology we've been reading about in secret teachings has this as the prime operative of manifestation, right? Remember when Ishtar descended through the seven gates, you know, to try to save Ormuz, it's the same thing. You know, she had to give up some part of her jewelry at each level. That is kind of the reverse of these governors who give a part, you know, bestow an attribute, right? So the first thing she had to give up was her crown. And that makes sense. As soon as you leave the highest level, you give up your crown, which represents the monad, right? So it's a fascinating, you know, the reason I love the secret teachings is because in all the mystery schools is that it shows other ways of describing this fundamental reality that the secret doctrine is here describing. Anyone else before we go on? So the upshot here is that Immanuel Kant recognized that primordial substance, which HPB identifies as Akasha, and recognized it to be the source of both the substance and movements of the planets. That's what's going on here.
She also is saying that Kant understood that idea because he was a reincarnation who philosophers or whatever who had studied this.
Well, certainly, you know, the fact that he was able to recapitulate by the age of 25 to the degree that he could activate his intuition is really remarkable. It shows, you know, an initiate level consciousness. In my mind, it does anyway. Okay, next up, can we get a reader, please?
Kirsten, I'm sorry. Can you read that for us, please? I don't see her coming in, so let's try Robert.
To the highest, we are taught, belong the seven orders of the purely divine spirits. To the six lower ones belong hierarchies that can occasionally be seen and heard by men, and who do communicate with their progeny of the earth, which progeny is indissolubly linked with them, each principle in man having its direct source in the nature of those great beings who furnish us with the respective invisible elements in us. Physical science is welcome to speculate upon the physiological mechanism of living beings and to continue her fruitless efforts in trying to resolve our feelings, our sensations, mental and spiritual, into functions of their inorganic vehicles. Nevertheless, all that will ever be accomplished in this direction has already been done, and science will go no farther.
So she's restating this idea. Any thoughts or questions on this? We have two additional quotes from Sacred Doctrine on the seven orders of the purely divine spirits. Let's take a look. First, quoting an esoteric commentary, HPB says, "It is through and from the radiations of the seven bodies of the seven orders of Dhyanis that the seven discrete quantities, elements, whose motion and harmonious union produce the manifested universe of matter are born." Then in Secret Doctrine, second volume, HPB says, "Moreover, the Vayu Purana declares all the seven orders to have originally been the first gods, the Vairajas, whom Brahma, with the eye of yoga, beheld in the eternal spheres, and who are the gods of gods." And the Matsya adds that the lesser gods worshiped them. So that relates to the seven higher orders. That would be the original seven emanations from Oyaohu the Younger, the seven Prajapatis, right? Dhyani Chohans, right? So next, to the six lower ones. Again, a couple of quotes, this time from HPB's collected works. Could we get a reader, please?
"What say the Ophites, the Nazarenes, and other heretics, Sophia, the celestial virgin, is prevailed upon to send Christos, her emanation, to the help of perishing humanity, from whom, the Jehovah of the Jews and his six sons of matter, the lower terrestrial angels, are shutting out the divine light. Thus, why Quan Shi Yin, or
Avalokiteshvara.
Okay, thanks. In Chinese symbology, is crowned with seven dragons, and here's the inscription, the universal savior of all living beings, the seven-headed basilisk of the text, of course, typifies a lower and material aspect of this type of emanation of the universe, and not the primordial spiritual serpent with its glory of seven rays or seven vowels. As there was a higher hebdomad of seven supreme planetary spirits, so there was a lower hebdomad, the Ophites allegorized this by saying that the serpent, in punishment for teaching Adam and Eve, the third race, to rebel against
Ildabaoth,
the spirit of the earth or gross matter, was cast down into the lower world and produced six sons, i.e. had to incarnate in the bodies of the early races."
Okay. Any thoughts or questions about this?
I think there might be a typo in that paragraph that starts with Veswa Quan Shi Yin. It says, "Here's the inscription." It might mean "bears the inscription."
That makes better sense, I think.
Yeah, I do too.
Third line down in that paragraph. Nope. Next. One below that.
There you go.
Oh, all right. Hang on a sec. That's seven Chinese symbols crowned with seven dragons. And yeah.
Bears.
Bears. It's yeah. Oops. Let me get out of here. And yeah, it's bears. Yeah, often the, you know, that's a mistake that's made in transcription. So let me get back in here. There we go. Thank you for that. Right. Way to pay attention, man. I missed it when I was I catch most of those, but once in a while I don't. Heptamad just means sevenfold, by the way. There was a higher, you know, seven and one and a lower heptamad. But the lower is six because six is the realm of manifestation, right? One, the highest of the seventh is always the unity of the lower six. Okay. So the lower six are the lunar petries, which are our ancestors because they created physical humanity. This is in counter distinction to the higher seven represented by the serpents in Avalokiteshvara's crown up here, who are the solar Agnishvata and the fashioners of the inner man, right? Manifested man and the inner man. In her collected works, HPB gives us a useful summary statement. So let's take a look at this, starting here with the six-pointed star.
Lynn, can you read that for us, please?
The six-pointed star refers to the six forces or powers of nature, the six planes, principles, etc., all synthesized by the seventh or the central point in the star. The higher dhyanis evolve lower and lower hierarchies of dhyanis, more and more consolidated and more material until we arrive at this chain of planets, some of the latter being the Manus, Petris, and lunar ancestors. As I show in the second volume of The Secret Doctrine, these Petris have the task of giving birth to man. They do this by projecting their shadows, and the first humanity, if indeed it can be called humanity, are the astral chahayas of the lunar ancestors, over which physical nature builds the physical body, which at first is formless. The second race is more and more formed and is sexless. In the third race, they become bisexual and hermaphrodite. And then finally, separating, the propagation of humanity proceeds in diverse manners.
Okay, thanks. So everybody get the connection here between the six lunar petries and the six root races here that are described, right? Which are unified in the final root race. There are literally beings, great petries, who overshadow each of these races. Okay. But HPB also warns us that communication with beings on invisible planes is very possible, not of a high order. So you have, wait a minute, first of all, okay, could we get a reader for this, please?
Scott, can you read that for us, please?
Yet by their spiritual sight, the adepts, and even some seers and sensitives, are always able to discern, whether in a greater or smaller degree, the presence and close proximity to us of beings pertaining to other spheres of life. Those of the spiritually higher worlds communicate only with those terrestrial mortals who ascend to them through individual efforts onto the higher plane they are occupying.
Okay, that's an important distinction here. You know, this is the answer, by the way, to how can God let the world, you know, be in such a mess? You know, well, the truth is that those great beings who are causal are contacted through ascension to their level, right? We're the ones, you know, by the way, that are responsible for the mess, not they. Okay, and then you have this reading about contacting those who are easily contactable. If we could get a reader, please.
Dana, can you read that for us, please?
Yes, thank you. Among the numberless hosts of spirit men that were, and those who will be men, there are those immeasurably superior to the human race, higher and holier than the highest saint on earth, and wiser than any mortal without exception. And there are those again who are no better than we are, as some are far worse and inferior to the lowest savage. It is the latter classes that command the readiest communication with our earth, who perceive and sense us as the clairvoyants perceive and sense them. The close proximity of our respective abodes and planes of perception are in favor of such intercommunication, unfortunately, as they are ever ready to interfere with our affairs for weal or woe.
Okay, any thoughts about this? So, you know, it being able to determine the quality and nature of that which is contacted on the other side is of supreme importance here. Because they're not in a body does not mean, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean that they're of a high order. In fact, if they're contactable, it's more likely that they're of a lower order because they're closer to the form aspect. They're closer to materiality in their consciousness, right? As said in the previous slide, the higher beings that one needs to ascend to their level in order to contact them. Okay. Next up, the indissoluble link between those hierarchies having to do with the world of form and first, each principle of man, and second, each invisible element in us. First, we have to remember that this section is about Lupikas and builders. On page 105 of Secret Doctrine, HPB says, the Lupika are connected with the destiny of every man and the birth of every child whose life is already traced in the astral light. Remember, in HPB speak, astral light is not the astral plane. It's all the higher realms. Not fatalistically, but only because the future, like the past, is ever alive in the present. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the Lupikas are connected with the destiny of every man. We tend to think of them as distant and of a higher order, but they're inextricably connected with each of us, right? So the Lupika are part of this indissoluble link, as are the Deva Lords of each subplane of the cosmic physical plane, who build under the direction of the Lupika the material sheaves for each of our aspects in accordance with our karma and where we are in our stage of evolution. Then the Ray Lords, in concert with Thohat, animate these principles with their particular streams of energy. Can we get a reader, please?
Robert, can you read that for us, please?
Every form on earth and every speck, atom, in space strives in its efforts towards self-formation to follow the model placed for it in the heavenly man. It's the atom's involution and evolution, its external and internal growth and development, have all one and the same object, man. Man is the highest physical and ultimate form on this earth, the monad in its absolute totality and awakened condition as the culmination of the divine incarnations on earth. The inner, now concealed man was then, in the beginnings, the external man. The progeny of the Dhyanis, Petris, he was the son like unto his father. Like the lotus, whose external shape assumes gradually the form of the model within itself, so did the form of man in the beginning evolve from within without.
Thank you, Robert. Any thoughts about this? Finally, HPP points out that scientific analysis of the quote-unquote physiological vehicle will never reveal the true source of life, which we've talked about. Let's finish this page and a half long paragraph. Can we get a reader, please?
Let me see. Lynn, can you read that for us, please?
She, science, is before a dead wall on the face of which she traces, as she imagines, great physiological and psychic discoveries, but every one of which will be shown later on to be no better than the cobwebs spun by her scientific fancies and illusions. The tissues of our objective framework alone are subservient to the analysis and researches of physiological science. The six higher principles in them will evade forever the hand that is guided by an animus that purposely ignores and rejects the occult sciences. All that modern physiological research in connection with psychological problems has, and owing to the nature of things, could have shown is that every thought, sensation, and emotion is attended with a remarshalling of the molecules of certain nerves. The inference drawn by scientists of the type of Buckner Vogt and others that thought is molecular motion necessitates a complete abstraction being made of the fact of our subjective consciousness.
Any thoughts about this? Questions? Okay, first, she is before a dead wall on the face of which she traces, as she imagines, great physiological and psychic discoveries, but every one of which will be shown later on to be no better than the cobwebs spun by her scientific fancies and illusions. So though physiology and psychology have advanced exponentially since the 1880s when the Secret Doctrine was written, the statement still fundamentally holds true for the sciences as a whole. Though researchers, again, like David Bohm and his followers, and Carl Jung and his followers, have and are penetrating beyond the seen and known in significant ways. The reason for this is found in HBB's next statement. The tissues of our objective framework alone are subservient to the analysis and researches of physiological science. Let's take a look at the footnote. For example, all that modern physiological research in connection with psychological problems has, and owing to the nature of things, could have shown, is that every thought, sensation, and emotion is attended by a remarshalling of the molecules of certain nerves. Meaning is clear. Thought, sensation, and emotion affect the nervous system in scientifically measurable ways. But only those willing to deny their own subjective reality could make the absurd claim that thought, for example, is molecular motion rather than causes molecular motion. There are actually a number of 19th century scientists who believed that thought was itself molecular motion. In other words, the movement of the molecules caused the thought. So it's cart before the horse kind of stuff. Here are Buchner and Voigt, by the way, self-described scientific materialists who held the view that there is nothing beyond the natural elements, principles, and relations of the kind studied by the natural sciences. Not to be unkind, but they kind of look the part, don't they?
Yep.
Okay, next, the six higher principles in them will evade forever the hand that is guided by an animus that purposely ignores and rejects the occult science. The six higher principles being all but the physical vehicle. In short, all that makes us who we are. Any thoughts or questions on anything in this segment?
What do you think of that phrase about the hand that is guided by an animus that purposely ignores and rejects? That there seems to be an implication of some deeper agenda there.
Yeah, I see what you mean. You know, belief can trump your own research and your own, you could say, curiosity. That spirit of determining the real can be squelched or inhibited by a belief system, right? And I think that's going on big time today in science in general, but it's being perforated more and more, and the younger scientists who are coming forth are starting to embrace the possibility of the unseen realms, right? But it's an old, old thought form, and it dies hard.
It also kind of implies that there's a like a dark lodge science, which is very, you know, really interesting. And you can see, yes, there are scientists today who are open to new ideas, but this kind of transhumanist science is, you know, can be seen as another form of modern dark lodge science.
Yeah, you know, the Dark Lodge, it's not necessary for them to actually step into these realms, because the past is a kind of form of the Dark Lodge. The past rules the present until something that is, that some new form that is intuited has enough power to start to dislodge it. And then that gradually gains momentum until the old is left behind. But it's always, you're always carrying the past, which has a quality of materialism, which is all the dark lodge is. You know, it's the orientation towards matter is the definition that DK gives of the Dark Lodge, right?
That was a great word you used, dislodge. I like that.
Dislodge the Black Lodge, right? Okay. Okay, next up. Can we get a reader, please?
The great day of be with us, then, is an expression, the only merit of which lies in its literal translation. Its significance is not so easily revealed to a public unacquainted with the mystic tenets of occultism, or rather, of esoteric wisdom or Buddhism. It is an expression peculiar to the latter, and as hazy for the profane as that of the Egyptians, who called the same the day of come to us, which is identical with the former. Though the verb be in this sense might be still better replaced with either of the two words remain or rest with us, as it refers to that long period of rest, which is called parinirvana.
Right. So parinirvana is is like pralaya. Any thoughts or questions about this? The term day be with us is completely symbolic. Language describes conditional reality. The concept behind the term day be with us is beyond all condition. For example, there is no actual day. Let the day be with us. With infers relationship. Let's see, absolute unity of the event will transcend. Likewise, us suggests plurality, which will have merged into not even unity, but a stage of beingness that is beyond even the singularity of unity. Because unity suggests a coming together of parts. The only word that holds some sense of the reality of the term day be with us is be. And I know this is different than how than what HPB just said, but be as in be-ness, as opposed to being-ness, which suggests the form aspect, right? Pure be-ness, right? Let's review part of what we read about the day be with us a couple of sessions back. Quote, then everything becomes one. All individualities are merged into one, yet each knowing itself. Then that which to us now is non-conscious or the unconscious will be absolute consciousness. Any thoughts or questions about this? This is truly as abstract as it gets. Let's take a look at the long footnote, which references, quote, the Egyptians called the same the day be the day of come to us. Anybody here comfortable with reading French? You can volunteer if you are.
I don't see any hands go up, but let me.
Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to read the first part and then through the French, and then we could get a reader to come in afterwards. Okay.
Okay.
Does that work? Okay. See Le Livre des Mots by Paul Pierret. Le jour devient à nous. C'est le jour où Osiris a dit au soleil, viens, je le vois rencontrant le soleil dans l'Amenti. It's probably a good thing we don't have French readers here. They could call me out on that pronunciation. But anyway, to keep going.
Scott, will you finish it, please?
I should have made you read the French.
Oh, no, you did it so well. The day of come to us is the day when Osiris says to the sun, come. I see him meeting the sun in the Amenti. The sun here stands for the Logos, or Christos, or Horus, as central essence synthetically, and is as a diffused essence of radiated entities, different in substance, but not in essence. As expressed by the Bhagavad Gita lecturer, it must not be supposed that the Logos is but a single center of energy manifested from Parabrahman. There are innumerable centers, and the number is almost infinite in the bosom of Parabrahman. Hence the expressions, the day of come to us and the day of be with us, etc.
Okay, thoughts or questions? Le Livre des Morts des Anciens Égyptiens is, of course, the Egyptian Book of the Dead, published just a few years before the Secret Doctrine came out. Of course, since I don't read French, I couldn't do much with it, but that's what it looks like. So we're going to be pulling the plug here in a minute, but next let's take a look at the term Amenti. And I think it's 2:45, so we'll pick up here next time. Could we have dates for the next webinars? I think we're right in line on the first and third Sundays, aren't we?
Yes, we are. The next Secret Doctrine is the third Sunday of March. It will be March 20th. And before that, we have the next, oops, No. We have the next secret teaching of all age. Oh, yeah. First Sunday, 6 March.
Yeah.
Okay. And I would like to put in a little plug. I'm going to send in the chat message. You know, we had a rather intense week saying goodbye to Michael Robbins, and we've compiled a lot of the chat messages that people said and some memorials that came in. And you can find them there at that page, that link on Makara. You can also just go to Makara, and we have a top line menu. You will see it that says tributes for MDR. So if you haven't had a chance to look at that, please do. So
yeah, it's definitely worth taking a look at. Also, I wanted to mention, if you're not getting notices for these, it's because of the switchover to Zoom meeting from Zoom webinar. Every time I have to go, I still don't get notices. It doesn't matter though, because you can go to moriafederation.com and it's right there. You can click on it and get right in. So, you know, I hope you all are getting a notification, but if you ever don't, you can easily find it on moriafederation.com. And then it's just usually right there on the left column. Any other business? Thanks very much. We'll see you next time.
Yeah, thank you, everybody. Goodbye.
Thank you.
Bye. Thank you.
Bye.